Radio City. John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you on PopDose.com, hanging out, doing a little talking about what's happening in the world. And Rob, how's everything going with you?
So far, so good. How are you doing, John?
Not bad, not bad. It's been a good week so far. I had a stray rock band end up staying at my house overnight, and that was a little weird, but hey, you know, these things happen.
Oh, I remember the days of having rock bands staying over at my house. An interesting, fun, delightful moment that I'll never forget, and one of my favorite memories of the days when I worked at record labels. So, yeah, I remember it well.
Yeah, and I have a very understanding wife. So, on that note, we've got a bunch to talk about. And we're going to kick off this week with one of your colleagues at PopDose, Ken Shane, because you and I have both grown a great affinity for his Soul Serenade column. Because, well, first of all, he picks out great music. And second, he does such a fantastic job in breaking it down for those of us who love the music and yet don't know much of the apocrypha of it, of the historical background. And this week, he went off in a little bit of a different direction. We've got an A-B comparison between two different takes on the same song. Roll us through this one a little bit.
And the great thing is that this particular song is one that, you know, all and sundry know. And it's an anthem, and it's an anthem that can be taken by one of two genders, you know?
Yep.
Because what we're talking about is Otis Redding's Respect. The question is, which do you prefer? Otis's original version, or of course the one that the whole world, I think, knows best, Aretha Franklin's version.
Right. So in a way, it's funny you should say that, because in a way the world has already made its vote on this, because Aretha's version is the one that everybody identifies.
That's very true. The thing is, though, if I had to have my, you know, if I have to have my druthers and I have to pick one, I'm going to take Otis's version because it's so much more raw.
Yep.
You know, Aretha's version is so polished and so tight and so on and so good. First of all, that was a no miss. You know, that had to be a massive hit. But the sheer ballsiness and grit of Otis's Stax version, or I'm sorry, if I'm going to be a purist about that, I should be. His Volt release.
Right.
You know, I got to go with Otis. Plus the fact that it is where my heart lies, and that is, it was a Stax Volt release. And, you know, I'll always, as wrong as I may be sometimes, but this is an opinion question, so there's no right or wrong answer. I'll always go with my heart over my sense of intellect or musical arrangement.
Yeah, and there's no question about it. Like you said, Aretha Franklin's version is so tight, so completely perfect in every way, that it's certainly not hacking on it to say, well, you know what, I like Otis's version better, because I think you and I have that in common. I like something that's a little more raw, a little more live. And if I have to sacrifice, there's another song title I'm going to pull out, Better Beautiful Than Perfect. I would rather have something that has a little added drive and a little added energy, a little added life to it, than something that is technically accurate.
Right. I mean, the thing about Aretha's version is that, yeah, it packs a wallop.
Yep.
Without a doubt, because of the way it just comes at you and hits you. But Otis's is grittier, and it's just more textured. There's just something about it. There's also, you know, if you really want to delve into the whole history of it, you know, when you know that the song Respect was actually, even though it's written from the male to female perspective on Otis's version, it's really about the burgeoning civil rights movement.
Right.
You know, Respect, period. So that's another reason why I give the nod and the edge to Otis for that song.
Yeah, but it's a wonderful piece of music history either way. So go check out Ken's Soul Serenading. You can get his take on matters. And of course, like everything on PopDose, there's added content, including both songs and videos that you can click on the page, so you can listen to them A-B and decide which one is the right one for you. And before we leave older music, we're going to go back a little bit newer than that, but you mentioned last time we talked that you had an article about a band that you and I were both just head over heels for at the time that this article came out. You've dug through the archives and found your copy of it. Which one are we talking about?
You're talking about my very first encounter with REM in print. Before I ever heard them play a note, This is how I was exposed to them, and this is what drove me into their collective arms. So for the first time on Radio City, or even in our previous incarnation, I'm going to read to you. Now, Uncle Rob's going to sit down.
Get comfortable, kiddies.
Exactly, because this is a true history lesson. This is from Musician Magazine, September 1982, even though it was purchased during August. Eddie Van Halen is the cover story, and the reason why I bought this issue is not because of Eddie V, but because there was a very rare American interview with The Jam. But lo and behold, there was a section of this magazine called Faces, which of course meant exposure for new artists, or underground artists who had not been given their due yet. REM were, in fact, the first band listed here. So this is what it has to say. And by the way, this was written by a gentleman named David Frick.
Oh, nice.
Just as there is the Motown sound, an ECM sound, and the sound of money rolling into Asia's bank account, there is definitely an Athens, Georgia sound. Maybe it's in the local drinking water or something they put in the cafeteria food at the University of Georgia. But whatever it is made the B-52s Young America's favorite party band and spawned an astonishingly long line of exceptional post-punk dance bands that include Gang of Avant-Funking Four Pylon, minimalist power duo The Method Actors, Art Surf Instrumental Miniaturists, Love Tractor, and now next big thing, REM.
At least they identified that.
You hear this quote-unquote sound first in the bottom, the hydraulic 4-4 pump of the drums, and combined brute uppercut and subtle harmonic articulation of the bass. Over this, there is often just one guitar, sometimes two, or the odd Vox Continental organ, as with the B-52s and Love Tractor, dancing in expanding melodic circles, not actually playing leads, but rather shifting glassine arpeggios and church bell chords that spread a liquid resonance over the Spartan rhythm thrust. Instead of singing, the vocalists engage in a kind of linear monologue, a highly stylized sing-speak ranging from Fred Schneider's Class Clowning with the 52s to the breathiness of Pylon's Vanessa. REM, which stands for Rapid Eye Movement, the deepest high dream ratio portion of sleep, have added an important new wrinkle to the Athens method by adapting it to pop songs. There is something of Pylon's jagged Nuevo Funk propulsion in their dance floor attack, certainly a strong hint of the B-52's go-go aesthetic in singer Michael Stipe's St. Vitus Fruging on stage. Where many of the Athens mob tend to write forceful rhythmic structures instead of shower singing tunes, REM cast a potent spell with an accessible, aggressive fusion of 60s pre-acid classicism, the streamlined angularity of current Britpop, and hellhound garage punk drive, the way the Fifth Dimension Birds, U2, and the Music Machine might sound together in one room. The magic certainly works long distance. The group's 1981 indie single debut, Radio Free Europe, back with Sitting Still, was a dark horse winner in the Village Voice Critics poll, 45 RPM division on the strength of its sunny wraparound hooks, an organic synthesis of almost pleading melodic gentility and celebratory dance spirit in the arrangements, and the band's own brash exuberance with Peter Buck's ringing guitar figures underpinned by bassist Mike Mills and drummer Bill Berry's emphatic step. Although it suffers from dry, rather indifferent production, REM's new IRS EP, Chronic Town, goes the single five better with a quintet of stirring originals that incorporates British Invasion revisionism, note the structural parallels between Gardening at Night and the record's Starry Eyes, the dark yet graceful lyricism of Vintage Love and their spiritual descendants Television, the driving cathartic carnival of sorts Boxcars, and the crack swagger of modern punk funk, 1 Million. And this was the key that got me. Through it all, Michael Stipe sings with the steely expression of the Hollies Alan Clark combined with the guttural bleeding of Roki Erickson. But based on a wired, wonderful workout in New York's Danceteria this past spring, neither record prepares you for REM's stage rage, the explosive, hooish collision of Buck's metallic guitar brash and Townsend's variations on the pogo, the bullish Rickenbacker boom of Mills, the steady slam by Barry. A strangely arresting figure in his ragged sweater, Stipe breaks into a psycho watusi and pounds his chest vigorously for vibrato, whipping his body across the stage the way Roger Daltrey slices the air with his microphone arc. Yet this whirling dervish energy never cancels out the native tunefulness of these songs. The last year has shown that there is assuredly a new pop in the American air. It's already part DBs, part flesh tones, part bongos. Now it's part REM, a very big part. Now, notice, the DBs and REM get proper mention and accordance. Two, A Million Equals But I'm Different Now by The Jam, right down to Mike Mills' bass line. And I'm sure if you spoke to Mike Mills, he would probably make the acknowledgement. But it was that 4-4 hydraulic pump and the mention of Alan Clark that made me think, okay, I've got to hear this band. And I would say it was maybe a week or so later. I was folding my laundry, getting ready to go back to school for my senior year in high school. And at the time, WSOU from Seton Hall it was a college station that had not gone full Metal Jacket yet, which was going to do shortly. And I don't remember the name of the young lady who was the DJ, but this song came on. And I sat there transfixed to it, and I listened to it. And I said out loud, this has got to be that band REM. It's just got to be. With the way the guy sounds, this has to be it. And at the end, she goes, and that was Wolves Lower from Chronic Town, the new EP by REM. Before that, we had Joy Division with Love Will Tear Us Apart, blah, blah, blah. I very quickly stopped folding laundry, made a beeline out the door, right past my mom, God rest her soul, who said to me, where are you going? And I said, I'm going into the city. I'll be back later. I've got to get something. And I ran up to J&R Music World, who didn't have any copies. So I went next door to Bondi's, which was the standby for me, who always seemed to have what I needed if J&R didn't. Uh-huh. And sure enough, I grabbed the copy. And my copy actually was the pressing that had the gargoyle on the label, which is apparently really rare to find. Nevertheless, I played that EP till White Grooves appeared in it, and REM became the thing for me. And as soon as they were coming to New York and they played at Maxwell's, I made my first trip to see them. I'd already made my first excursion to see the Bongos at Maxwell's previously, but to see REM, and that was it. And the great thing was REM came at that right moment for me because the Jam were about to break up, and it saved me from basically having a musical nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
What was I going to do without the Jam? Paul Weller was everything, but it had REM to fall back on. And it was another band driven by Rickenbackers. And they were American. And by the time that REM completely got its tenterhooks into me, which was by high school graduation a few months later, because Murmur became our soundtrack. We played the cassette of that in the car on the way to rehearsals, before the ceremony, afterwards when we all went out to party together. That was the cassette that we played, till it basically rotted.
Yeah. But
that album was it. That was the album of 83 for me and for a lot of my friends. And I'm very grateful to be able to say that I turned on in one of those rare moments when I was always arguing the unwinnable fight of how brilliant the Jam were, or the Buzzcocks, or the Undertones, or whatever punk band it was, but I was able to turn my friends onto REM. And that's why to this day, I always seem to get that, whenever I hear REM, I think of you, which I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, or if it's because my innumerable times of doing my, Pete Buck imitation with a guitar, or my humorously meant imitations of Michael Stipe ad infinitum. That was the beginning of the whole incredible love affair with REM. And also what was most important was that article led to me following them in print and led to the following of what became, as you and I know, as the American Underground that came up in that post-punk wave of, because don't forget, this is a really important factor. That article, which was written in 1982 at the tail end, was just as the British bands that we all loved were all breaking up, because you had that one really bad week. The Jam, XTC for a while, Squeeze, The Teardrop Explodes, Blondie, all these bands announced their breakups.
Just evaporating,
Yeah, and suddenly we were left with this gaping void. REM stepped in at the right moment.
Yeah.
And they this all up.
Well, and it's funny because you and I both became that sort of ambassador. And it, with me, it was a couple of years later because in New York, you got everything immediately. In Tampa, it took a little while. And there was that period of time where that was all happening and we didn't know it. So our first real introduction to them on the radio, even whatever Tampa had that sufficed for underground radio at the time, was not until Fables of the Reconstruction. So the very first song that I heard from REM was Driver 8. And it hit, pardon the expression or the bad pun, it hit like a train. I thought, this song is fantastic. I got to find out who these guys are. And they came in concert about a month later. I played the secondary room at the Bayfront Center in St. Petersburg, and I went there not knowing a thing about the following, not knowing who this band's fans were, not caring, and simply showed up in a pair of jeans and an old shirt and walked in and saw kids in makeup and kids with the mohawks and, you know, crazy dyed hair and piercings and all of this, and I thought, what have I gotten myself into? I just wanted to hear a good band.
You know, wonderfully, and this is where I have to emphasize the beauty of the whole REM. I don't think I'd use the word experience, but the whole envelopment. Well, there's two things. One, I will say that in that article, of course, the mention of the bongos and the DBs.
Yeah.
When Repercussion had been released, I'd gotten it, and that was in I think March of '82. And I can't remember the exact time frame, but I also already hadn't started beating to death Drums Along the Hudson by the Bongos. That sound was already there.
Yeah.
It already had been, preempted, by both the Bongos and the DBs. So, of course, they were local to us. They were our bands because they were Hoboken and New York based, and of course, we loved them. So in a lot of ways, there was that one little raised eyebrow of now, hang on, fellas, this sounds a lot like the Bongos and the DBs.
Right.
But nevertheless, the other thing is, and this is a really important point, because you were talking about having been really indoctrinated by the time of Fables. Now, mine was an all-encompassing thing, and when I joined 2 Minutes 8 in August of 83, right after high school graduation, our intent was to be the Jam. But the thing was, I really wanted to push us towards the REM thing, because why are we going to try and be a British band when we're all from Staten Island? That was number right. one. I mean, we were the best British band to come out of Staten Island as the very beginning of 2 Minutes 8, when we were doing our whole Jam, Buzzcocks, Undertones, Gang of Four kind of thing. But there came a point where, we decided very consciously, and the key was, it was after our... of all things, July 4th gig in the summer of 84. Now, Reckoning was already out, and Reckoning broke the myth of the sophomore jinx.
Yep.
Because this was, I think, a far more lively and much more gritty, and all four members in the studio playing at the same time, less textured kind of record than Murmur was. But it was the day after the gig, and our bass player, Mark, was going to meet me at the – I grew up in a town called Eltingville. He lived one town away in a town called Great Kills. But he was going to take the train, meet me at the train station. While I was waiting for him, I picked up a copy of – well, it's known again as The Aquarian, and that's how I met the guys in the band. But at that moment, they changed the name to the East Coast Rocker. It was the local weekly musical newspaper mm-hmm. and musicians newspaper in the New York tri-state area. REM were on the cover. For the first time, they made a cover story. And I'm standing there and I'm reading it. And, he gets off the train and we're just kind of talking. And it just kind of popped out of my mouth arbitrarily. I was like, something? I really think I'd like to bag the whole mod and British thing. I think we're just doing this wrong, because there's that whole mod scene in Jersey. And it's, I don't know, it just seems silly for us to want to be part of something that's been done so wrongly. Mod really doesn't work as an American translation. It looks great, but they're all aping the Jam and lesser quality bands like Secret Affair and so on and so forth. And you know what? We look like idiots doing this, and we really shouldn't. And I held up the paper. I said, this is the direction we really should be going. And Mark stunned me by turning around and saying, I was thinking the same thing.
Wow.
Let's bag the matching outfits. Let's bag the Rickenbacker too. The whole uniformed look. and we consciously decided to go about becoming ourselves. And as we were walking to the bus and just kind of hanging out and, you know, we're reading our way through the city. You know, it's like, hey, let's go into the city today. Now that we've gotten that out of the way, let's just go do something cool. And we decided actually to go see a Wim Wenders movie. I think it might have been Wings of Desire, but I don't really remember. I could be wrong, but maybe I've got the time frame wrong. But or maybe it was Hammett. I just don't remember. It was 1984, so whatever movie he had out in that summer. And we decided to take the bus down to the ferry instead because we were just going to kill a whole day because it was still early in the morning. And we're reading our way through Aquarian Weekly, and this is the key part. In it was – first of all, quarter page ads for that week's new releases. One of them was from SST Records, and those new releases included Zen Arcade by Husker Du, Double Nickels on the Dime by the Minutemen.
Right.
And the Meat Puppets second album, Meat Puppets 2. There was also an ad for the Ritz, which was the premier concert venue in Manhattan. And on those lists of upcoming shows, Husker Du, the Minutemen, the Replacements were coming.
Yeah.
That to me was truly, and this is for me, the pivotal moment. That was the ground zero moment when the American underground movement came up from under the earth and blossomed and it took us in. It absorbed us. Because from that moment forward, we never really looked back at the British bands. You know, we drew upon what we saw as our contemporaries. Now, you know, a lot of those bands, you'd say, well, they were coming out of the hardcore scene. Sure, but it doesn't matter. They were American bands from very different areas. You had REM in Athens.
Right.
You had Husker Du in Minneapolis, along with the Replacements. You had the Minutemen from San Pedro. You had the Meat Puppets from Arizona. You had the Bongos from Hoboken. And you had the DBs from, well, from the Chapel Hill Triangle by way of New York City. So, you know, I thought we fit in very nicely with that kind of scope. And sure enough, we started to develop into ourselves because the next gig, I remember being kind of nervous. We didn't have another gig for another month, by which time I stopped styling my hair in that kind of pseudo-mod vein. And my hair is naturally very wavy and curly. So I just kind of let it go, you know. And
yeah.
Instead of wearing a jacket and tie and a suit and being all trussed up, I wore a striped shirt and a bandana because that's what you did back in the 80s. And you know, I actually had the balls to wear an earring at that time instead. You know, and we just looked like ourselves. And I thought, because we had a very small and very loyal fan base. And I thought, they're going to hate us. They're going to kill us. But they loved it. They absolutely loved it. And they embraced us. Now, 2 minutes hate didn't last too much longer. We called it a day in early 85 because, you know, one of the guys went to college. The other one moved back to New Jersey. And that led Mark and I to want to really evolve into a different band. And that's how the Punchline started to morph out of that. But that was and it was all because of the whole REM thing. Them just being on that cover of the newspaper and me saying to Mark without really having any fear or trepidation of saying, I really think we need to pivot on what the band is doing. And him being in agreement, I think that was our key moment. So, you know, REM played such a major part in everything. And of course, you and I may have talked about this in the past. I don't know. You know, the apex was when the original four-piece Punchline was breaking up in 1992. The last thing we ever did together was we appeared on the worldwide REM tribute album, Surprise Your Pig. We did the track Bandwagon. And that, in fact, turned out to be the single that was released with the vinyl version of the album. So, you know, a lot can be said that am I grateful to REM? Yes, I am.
Good man. Very much so. Yeah, very good. And again, Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you, doing a little talking on Radio City this week. We've got some new music to go over, and we'll head off to Popdos once again and talk a little bit about a band called Gretchen's Wheel. Who is Gretchen's Wheel?
Gretchen's Wheel is actually the brainchild of a young lady named Lindsay Murray, who is now on, I believe, her third album under the moniker Gretchen's Wheel. She is Tennessee-based and certainly knows how to craft a pop song and a damn fine series of them. You know, just to give you a very, very quick glimpse at some of her cohorts, let's start with Ken Stringfellow of the Posies.
Nice.
And of Big Star, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Or Andy Reid of our beloved, well, yours and mine, The Legal Matters.
Yep.
You know, I mean, these guys have helped her create these series of albums that are just stunning. But the most important thing is her sense of songwriting and musicianship. And there's a natural warmth. And I want to say definitely a progression between the three records. You know, the first album, which was called Fragile State, which was very atmospheric, kind of took a turn towards a little more poppy and accessible with last year's Behind the Curtain. But this one's just very alive. It's very buoyant.
You know what I liked about it is you talked about the songwriting and the song crafting, but there's also, in a couple of the songs on here, there's a real throwback feel, and there's a lot of things like, I mean, something as simple as adding a little tambourine to a song, just to give it a little more of that atmosphere that you talked about. That's there, and it gives you that sort of comfort food of the music of the 1960s, and yet it doesn't lose its new sound.
No, and the beauty of it is, and it goes right into what you just said, nuances are everything, and people overlook the tinier details or the more traditional details of nuance in something with a tambourine or maybe using a shaker or not filling a song with a keyboard but just adding maybe a punch here and a punch there. You'd be surprised. It's always the less is more theory, but you know, these songs, she's got this wonderful ability of also, and you and I both love this concept, of knowing when and when not to play.
Yes.
Case in point, you know, there's a song called Left Turn, and it's kind of hard, you know. It's got this kind of tight toughness to it. It's got this really strident rhythm, but it's got a pop sensibility, and it doesn't go into indulgent guitar solos. It has that 1-2 punch of the way the guitar solo is heard, and that's it. You know, you give the song what it's about. The song, you give the song what it needs. She understands this. She has mastered this, and she also not only knows how to write hooky, catchy, here it comes, radio-friendly songs, but you know, she also threw in what I would consider is the closest to a radio-friendly Nashville type of song on the album with a song called "Wish," and just. She's really got that something, and that something is right.
Yeah, it's an album called Sad Scientist, and it's out from Gretchen's Wheel. You can check out some of the music from it. There's a whole primer on the new album online at popdose.com, along with Rob Ross's review. And the other new one, and actually, before we get to Peter Bradley Adams, you mentioned something about the nuance and the way that you hit, even the way that you hit a chord. If there's anybody who's listening to us who has not yet seen the Pet Sounds documentary, see it. There's a little brief piece in that where they talk about the fact that Brian Wilson was having trouble with a particular keyboard part. He didn't like the way it sounded. And so the keyboard player, who was one of the Wrecking Crew, simply said, well, how about instead of playing chords, we play it short. And I just hit them, each one on the beat. And that tiny change made a huge difference in the way the song sounded.
Especially because it was Don Randy, who
That's
is
right.
such an incredible keyboard player.
Yep.
You know, shortening or sculpting, if you will, that middle break on God Only Knows.
That's it.
I may not always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you.
That song, exactly what it should become. But the beauty of it is that Brian Wilson was willing to listen.
Yeah.
It wasn't a case of him saying, no, this is my song and it's my ode to God, or there was no ego involved. It's like, okay, let's see if it works. Wow, I really like that. Let's keep that.
Right. And sometimes something that simple can make all the difference in the world. But yeah, that documentary is really something special.
It is, and as we speak, he's on tour for the final lap of the Pet Sounds 50th anniversary. I think he's probably going to retire from live performances.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Which is why they're saying that, you know, it's done. So,
yep. See him while you can. And now that brings us perfectly into Peter Bradley Adams, because brand new music out from him. And again, Rob Ross has the review for you on popdose.com. And what I like about him, the song that you have linked on the page, along with the review, along with the article, is the fact that it is so unabashedly folk. And I love the fact that it doesn't try to be something that it's not. He doesn't try to build an Americana song out of this.
No, I think it's just a very natural thing for him. You know, his style is that mixture of Americana and folkiness and down home and a little bit of, that rural sound. But he does it in a pop way. He doesn't make it so obtuse that it's unlistenable
right.
or tedious, which, look, a lot of times, you know, artists will try and you applaud them for their attempts at growth. But the fact is, they just don't know when to not do something. You know, when you go into a terrain that doesn't work for you, you run the risk of sinking very quickly into musical quicksand. But this particular record, what I like about it is that it certainly fit my mindset when I listened to it, because it felt like a warm blanket on a very cold day.
Yellow hair and almond skin. She opened her arms and right in, and she gave me love like I never knew. What in the world can a good man do? Well, her hands are warm, her hands are strong. She holds me here like I belong. But I know I can't love her like she wants me to. What in the world can a good man do?
You know, that's how it kind of envelops you and takes you in.
Yep.
And he's got a really nice, he's got that kind of soft, sometimes soft vocalization that some people can do breathy. Colin mm-hmm. Blunson is the master of breathy.
Right.
Very few people can do it and do it in a way that you don't sit there going, come on, sing, show some gusto. It's a very simple musical sophistication that Peter Bradley Adams has. And that's what I like so much about this record. You know, case in point, the track you were talking about, the video, Good Man, you know, it's a quietly picked guitar, you know, it builds up slowly. Then there's some very subtle keyboards and a very fine but not intrusive slide guitar. And then his vocals just come in quietly and it floats in and out, kind of like a vocal cloud.
Yeah.
You know? There was one that made me laugh, and I'm sure you're going to laugh. There was a track on there called Lorraine. And, it's a straightforward love letter / plea. But when you're listening to it, and this is what I liked about it, rather than feeling savage towards it, but while I was listening to it, I found myself very easily singing Rock On by David Essex.
Okay.
Punching in Drive by R.E.M., since that's the same song.
Yeah, right.
But it works, you know, it just works.
Well, and that's one of those things, again, going back to that, the little things that make an album, there's a kind of a... He's from Birmingham, Alabama. Peter Bradley Adams that we're talking about, he's from Birmingham, Alabama. And that area has, because of the swamps and the music that comes out of them, there's a kind of a thump. There's a percussive nature to his guitar playing that really comes through. And I think that's why the David Essex connection, because that's just thumping on the bass. So it adds a quality into the music that isn't there with a lot of people who attempt to write something that's a stripped down folk song, but it just adds that much, and that much makes all the difference.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And again, it's a very well produced album because it's so stark that it makes it sound not claustrophobic. Sometimes when you go into a really strongly acoustic based performance, it just sounds a little muted and too stuffy.
Yep.
This one has a crispness about it. And that's what I take away with a great deal of appreciation for the quality of the performance.
Yeah. And the album, again, is called A Face Like Mine. It's out from Peter Bradley Adams. And, of course, the review and some music elsewhere on popdose.com. And we've got one more musical thing to mention in the conversation this week before we get to the In Our Heads section. And it comes by way of, again, last week's conversation, because we talked about another one of the articles that was up on Popdose about fake bands. You're going to have to remind me who it was that wrote that one.
Oh, it was Mr. Dunphy.
And that was D.W. Dunphy. Okay, that's what I thought, but I didn't want to miscredit. So of all of the phony bands, the ersatz put-together bands for a movie or a TV show, he put the Wonders into the article. And you and I both love That Thing You Do. It's a terrific movie, but there's news about the Wonders this week. What happened?
Oddly enough, they got back together and played. It really was the one-hit wonders, as in, I wonder what happened to the O'Neaters.
Right.
You know, there was a party, and Jonathan Scheck, Tom Everett Scott, and...
Steve Zahn.
No, Steve Zahn wasn't there.
Oh, he wasn't? Oh.
Oddly enough. Ethan Embry got together and performed That Thing You Do, note perfect. And it was a terrific little clip to see. I couldn't help but laugh, but I mean, it was just great to see it, especially in light of our conversation.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that is cool. And it is. It's such a great song. And that's another one of those. I mean, the same way that Eric Idle was always the frustrated genius musician, I think Tom Hanks has a little bit of that as well, because he, as you said, he wrote all the music for that movie, and that song just works. If that had come out in 1963, it would have been a massive hit.
Right, the incidental music was, in fact, Tom Hanks. But, you know, here's an important thing that I overlooked and kind of taking the cue and running with it from Mr. Dunphy, was that there's a movie that very few people have seen. I wouldn't call it a cult movie because it hasn't gained enough of an audience to know so, but it's called Bandwagon, oddly enough. And it came out in 1997. I saw it on a fluke on cable. It's about the formation of a band in, I think it was, North Carolina. It's a fictional story, and the writer actually was one of the earlier drummers of the Canals.
Okay.
In fact, Doug McMillan, who's the lead singer of the Canals, is one of the stars of the movie. He plays the mysterious but very well-respected manager of this band. But it's about the formation of a band of four misfits who just want to play the kind of music that their main songwriter and lead singer envisions playing. And they're going up against, you know, some competition in town against a kind of lame metal band called Spittle. And the music in that movie is so terrific. It's kind of a sort of palatable Replacements. Imagine the Replacements around Please to Meet Me.
Okay.
That kind of palatability, you know. The movie was terrific. The music is terrific. The band, which called themselves Circus Monkey, just a classic movie. This is one that is so overlooked, it has to be spoken about and given a little bit of light shined on it, because it's such a good movie. Hard to find. You may, if you have a VCR, you can find video copies. Amazon actually will print copies for you. And if you find the soundtrack, grab it, because the songs are great.
Excellent. That movie, again, is called Bandwagon. Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you, talking over some of the latest. And we move into the politics section, because we're going to wind up within our heads this week. But... yet again, we had a Saturday night that just happened, wherein the President of the United States, for the first time since the Reagan assassination attempt, skipped the White House Correspondents' Dinner, had a little rally of his own, because even though he's not campaigning, he still does nothing but campaign rallies because he loves people applauding him. And everything else this week has just been a mishmash of people trying to defend him and defend the people that used to work for him, in the midst of swirling allegations and more possibilities of subpoenas flying around, even to the point where Rudolph Giuliani is now trying to duck a subpoena. I mean, it's just gotten insane.
Well, the fact that he didn't have the sheer courage. Is that diplomatic enough?
I think so.
He didn't have the guts or the balls to actually show up for the annual Correspondents' Dinner. Says a lot.
Yep.
That's because he's managed to alienate every single element behind the press. You know, even his most ardent apologists are no longer apologists.
Right.
You know, he's out there campaigning for what? I don't know. Is it to still keep people convinced that he's the man for the job? Maybe. But all I can say is that he hasn't got a clue. And he has, he's crippled himself. And I think he's now backed himself into such a corner that it's going to be interesting. And I'm saying that with a lot of trepidation.
Right. I mean, the fear is that he lashes out. And unfortunately, as president of the United States, he has the ability to lash out in such a way that will cost lives.
Yeah. Well, that's the key component, the cost of lives. You know, what the hell is he going to do? What is he doing? What is the motivation here for anything? Will anything get done in Congress? You know, this laundry list has grown exponentially to the point of you could have had it on a short list of will there be indictments for the yes or no factor behind the contact with Russia,
right?
The lack of vetting process, you know, the false allegations made up left, right, and center by Trump and his insanity. You can go down all of it, but now there's these subparts. So this has become almost like a parchment scroll of nothing.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, the real bullshit about it that's happening at the moment is that now you've got all the surrogates because it's finally gotten to the point where they just can't anymore. They can't defend the lies because they're indefensible. They were always indefensible, but they did the same standard, you know, Kellyanne Conway horse shit and tried to cover up for them. So now the line is, well, don't pay attention to what he says, just pay attention to what he does. The problem with that is, A, he hasn't really done anything, and B, what he said got him elected. So don't give me this shit about, oh, don't pay attention to what he says, because he lied his way into the White House. So now you're telling me, oh, yeah, but don't pay. It's funny how they didn't say don't pay attention to what he says when he was on the campaign trail.
Well, the interesting thing is also his constant sense of obfuscation for everything. The minute shit is about to hit the fan.
Yeah.
He does a 360 and says, oh, look over here.
Right.
I mean, look at how many times we've heard the words North Korea all week.
Yep.
You know, and people are, unfortunately, beginning to panic and freak out that we're going to go to nuclear war with them. You know, World War III is not happening this week. People need to not worry. What we need to be concerned with, and this is the thing that we've needed to be concerned with from the get-go, pure and simple, is keeping an eye on Trump and his cronies because we don't know what they're up to.
Right.
What is the end game here? And the question is, what is the end game? We don't know. We just don't know anymore. And it's distressing in the sense that we can't get a read on anything. There is
right.
no form of truth.
No.
And I hate to say it, the press hasn't helped. They really haven't been helping.
No.
Not doing their jobs. They're busy instead patting themselves collectively on the back, saying, look how we're trying to hold Trump up to snuff and calling him out. No, you're not. You're reporting all of his shenanigans, but you're not bucking against him with facts, with documents and eyewitnesses.
Right. Yeah, and doing it in front of him. There was one guy who tried over the weekend and unfortunately, again, failed miserably. So there's one other piece to that puzzle that I think is going to be a fascinating one if and when we ever get a good read on this, which is you mentioned the end game. I think it's what you said, which is we need to know what the end game is. The other thing that we don't know is whose end game are we talking about? Because it sure as hell isn't Donald Trump's. He doesn't know what the fuck he's doing. From minute to minute, he has no idea.
Well, you've just struck upon the most poignant moment of the week. And it happened a couple of times when he said, I thought this job was going to be a lot easier.
Right.
Really?
Right. I miss my old life. Well, here's a clue. Quit. Go back to your own life. With our blessing.
It doesn't even seem like he's deterred from his old life because every weekend he's playing golf down in Florida. Not doing his job instead and being in the White House.
Right. So who's running things and in what direction are they running them?
Well, you bring up now the really salient point. What is the end game? Well, perhaps the end game is for him to find a way to get out of it so he can turn the reins over to Mike Pence. That way it's a completely – I mean, not that it isn't already, but so far Congress doesn't want to do anything that would help Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Considering it's a completely Republican-controlled Congress. Now – being the case, if they turned it over to Pence, would then Congress be willing to work with Pence to turn this back into 1950s, you know, Nostalgiaville? I don't know. But the thing is, the only way Trump would probably try and maneuver a deal is so that there's an assurance that he doesn't wind up in prison for all his crimes. Because what he has done is completely anti-constitutional.
Oh, yeah. And as far as Mike Pence is concerned, there's an irony in that as well, because if it really was, and I think it probably was, the wackos who made the difference, because he was going to get the Republican vote. Republicans are... Bill Maher on Real Time last week used the word tribal, and I think he's absolutely right about that. There's a tribalism that inhabits conservatives in this country that makes them unwilling and unable to vote for somebody who's not in their own party. So what you end up with is the crazies making the difference. It was the Steve Bannon, Breitbart assholes who put Donald Trump in office. There just happened to be a bunch of them in Michigan and Ohio and, you know, all of the places Hillary had as her firewall that fell apart. So if that's the truth, then those people, if they end up with Mike Pence, are going to end up with exactly what they said they didn't want, which is a socially conservative neocon back in the White House.
Which is exactly what they seem to want, because Donald Trump, the fact that they haven't figured out yet in the slightest way possible that Donald Trump is neither a Democrat nor a Republican.
Right.
He's P.T. Barnum.
He's a Donald Trump fan.
Right. It's all about him and only him. Now, on the flip side of that, though, you know what? The tribalism, the new tribalism of the extreme left, the left that's led by Bernie Sanders, they're no different.
Right.
Absolutely no different. And I'm glad to see and hear other people who are, in fact, Democrats, long-term Democrats out there finally saying, okay, cut the shit. First of all, where are your tax returns? Every time you feel the need to talk about, and we're talking about Bernie Sanders here, you feel the need to castigate Hillary Clinton for one imagined crime or another, where are your tax returns, Bernie?
Yeah.
The third house, you know, you have three houses. Let's talk about your wife's dealings, shall we? You know, there's a laundry list of shit that's so dirty on that man, and I am waiting with bated breath for the day that he too gets his comeuppance.
Right.
Because I see Bernie Sanders as a mirrored reflection on the left of Donald Trump. They both set out to do one thing and one thing only, for whatever reason. But that maybe it's ego gratification, maybe it's psychosis, maybe it's a combination of the two. But both of them wanted to fuck up everything royally, and Trump is doing it, and Bernie's doing it with the new left.
Right.
Because him and his league of it's almost a cult-like sea of social justice warriors who have no idea what they're talking about, marching for this week's, you know, cause celeb. You know what? I've never seen a bigger bunch of insincere assholes in my life.
Right.
And I'm at points ashamed to say that I was always more left-leaning than anything. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I'm 52 years old. I'm fiscally conservative because at this point in my life and at this age, you have to be wise with your money, especially in an uncertain time. If you're spending it willy-nilly on your causes or whatever, noble, but you better have backup when, God forbid, you need it.
Well, sure.
And socially, you know what? Live and let live. I don't need to have things taken apart in such a microscopic manner and force-fed to me that I have to see your point of view because you said so because it's the right thing. You know, God forbid you don't agree with these people. They turn on you like a rabid pack just the same way that the extreme right do.
Right.
There is absolutely no discernible difference.
No, and the only real difference is that the tribalists on the right all voted for Donald Trump. The tribalists on the left all abandoned Hillary Clinton. That's why she lost. So, yeah, it's a crazy situation. But, you know, that's why it bears watching. And as we continue our conversation, we go back into the world of music because we always like to end on a high note. And in our In Our Heads segment this week, and we didn't even talk about this before the show, but I'm going to go back to another one that my phone and its infinite wisdom picked out for me this week because I have been a reggae fan since I was about four, and my dad got the soundtrack to the movie The Harder They Come, The Harder They Fall. And Jimmy Cliff and Toots Hibbert and everybody that's on that album, I mean, it's just so fantastic. And yet, there's one song that I think is the hardest one on that record to classify as a reggae song, because really, it isn't. And yet, I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces of music, from the church organ at the beginning all the way through, when Jimmy sings Many Rivers to Cross. It almost is. It's the closest thing to a religious experience from music.
Many rivers to cross, but I can't.
That guy's voice and that music over, you know, that it lays over top of, not to mention the beauty of the lyrics in that song. Just what an incredible piece of music. If you ever need to make yourself feel better, put on Many Rivers to Cross, you'll be fine.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up that song, because I remember going back and giving it a listen after reading the book High Fidelity when it first came out.
Yeah.
Because there's a conversation, and let's not even draw upon the movie version, but there's a conversation in the record store between Rob and Barry and who's the third one? What's the name of the third character?
I don't remember.
Oh, dear. Dick.
Yes, right.
Dick. And they're talking, this is after Rob's girlfriend Laura's father dies, and they're talking about songs they want played at their funeral. And I think it was Rob who picked Many Rivers to Cross. And, you know, maybe go back and listen to that. And that is one of those very powerful songs. But, you know, I'm not one to use the phrase religious moment, but there are some songs that when I hear them, and it doesn't matter how many times, how often, how many years the songs have been, you know, in my orbit or whatever, that these songs will, in fact, alternately or simultaneously put a tear in my eye or put tears in my eyes, no matter what, where I can't sing along because I'll get choked up.
Mm-hmm.
Or just give me absolute goosebumps, even at this point in time. One of the ones that always, and there's obviously a very big, you know, emotional impact, especially now in the last couple of years, Let It Be Me by the Everly Brothers is one of those songs that has always, it's always made me feel warm, highly emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Each time we meet, love, I find complete love. Without your sweet love, what would life be? So never leave me lonely. Tell me you love me only, and that you love.
Always puts tears in my eyes. Always makes me choke up. Even when we would try and do it, because the guitar player of the Punchline and I used to do a side acoustic project, and we'd always do Everly Brothers. It always seemed like by the end of us doing the last verse on Let It Be Me, even though I sang lead on it, I would always get choked up because of the beauty, the pure beauty, because it's such a simple lyric, but it's so eloquent and so heartfelt and so believable that there has to be that special someone you're singing it to, that I would always wind up having to struggle with it because I was getting choked up by it. Now, the truth is, you know, it meant, I think, its most to me when I was dating this young woman back in the 80s. And, you know, she was always there in the audience, and I would always sing it to her specifically. And at one point when we had talked seriously about getting married, that might have been our wedding song. Well, she passed away a few years ago, so of course I can't listen to the song without crying. No matter what, I hear it come on the radio and I'm driving, I start to cry. It still has that much emotional impact, but now add this element behind it, and it makes it even more of a powerful thing for me. But there are songs that will always have my heart, no matter what, in that vein, in the good way, in the positive way, or in just that warming way of, you know, it's going to sound silly. When I hear Pilgrimage by REM,
mm-hmm.
it's one of those songs that uplifts me.
Yeah.
You know, ironically, because it's called Pilgrimage, it does have that religiosity about it. The Bulrushes, again, a religiosity about it. Now, whether it's the Bongos version or the Punchlines version, that's up for debate. Talk to me on a day when my ego may not be running rampant, because I'll get back to you on which one's the better version, you know? I'm just kidding, Richard, if you're listening. am I?
Yeah.
You know, that's another one of those songs. You go back to the 60s. A Rose for Emily by the Zombies is one of the most breathtakingly beautiful things you'll ever hear.
Yeah.
You know, the simplicity of it, with just the piano of Rod Argent and the vocals of Colin Blundstone, then leading into that vocal buildup where they kind of do a cycle around each other, is exquisite. It's angelic is what it is. Of course, God Only Knows does rank up there. It's
sure.
one of chill-inducing songs. It's beautiful. Is it really a religious moment? You better believe it.
Yeah.
The most important thing about so many of these songs is the fact that for it to be a near religious experience, you have to have a heart. You know, it has to go in concert with the soul.
Right.
And when you hear these songs and it grabs you and it pulls you in and it lifts you up in such a manner, that's when you know you've got something for you that's for all time.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, there are those songs, as you kind of alluded to, that have an experience that goes along with them. And I've got one of those in the song, oddly enough, is Someone Saved My Life Tonight by Elton John. And that one, because of a person and an experience and a time and a place, is one that all these years later, every time that one comes on, I get a little tear in my eye. So, yeah, I mean, but that's, again, that's the power of music. And it's not that we ever forget the people and the places and the things, but it's the music that always brings it back.
Well, the beauty of it is, you know, wrapping that whole theory up in a package is that as we've gotten older, music truly becomes, you know, it's about creating a memory, and a memory that will hopefully last all time, 9 times out of 10 for the better. Sometimes there's a sad epilogue.
Yeah.
You know, there are those songs that also when you're feeling your worst, you'll hear that one particular song that will help pull you out of the emotional abyss. I mean, whether it's a song that shouts, if you will, or has a guttural scream, a song like Sorry Somehow by Husker Du is one of those songs that I can think of. Well, that's one of the most poignant ones for me. I mean, if I'm being really honest, that or Out of Your Life by Bob Mould, you know, simple, powerful, to the point. If you want me out of your life, all you got to do is tell me now.
Right. And that's why we always spend a little time in our heads here at the end of our conversations. And Rob Ross, always good talking to you. Thank you so much for hanging out with us on Radio City again this week. We'll do some more next time. And one of the things I know we'll be talking about next time is another friend of ours, Bob DeStefano, and his band, The Blood Rush Hour. New music out from them. So we've got that coming up and lots more on our next get-together. Rob, good talking to you as always.
Thank you, John. Have a great week. Stay well, and I will catch up with you very soon.
You got it. Make sure you're here with us on the next edition of Radio City.